The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jackie Marino for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Nutrition News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Nutrition Action Health Letter. Overload, Five Factors That Make You Eat, by Bonnie Liebman. Researchers are scrambling to figure out why ultra-processed foods may lead to weight gain. In the meantime, here are five factors that consistently lead people to overeat. 1. Calorie density. Calorie density is the number of calories in each bite that you eat, says Barbara Rolls, professor of nutritional sciences at Penn State University. In the 2019 study showing that people gain weight on ultra-processed foods, those foods had roughly twice the calorie density of the unprocessed foods. If you increase calorie density by 30%, you're likely to eat about 30% more food, says Rolls. What makes foods more or less calorie dense? Water is the main player, explains Rolls. Water-rich foods are lower in calorie density than dry foods. That boils down to substituting fruits and vegetables for other foods. Fat also matters, says Rolls. It has twice as many calories in each bite as carbohydrate or protein, but you needn't avoid all fat. Use it judiciously, she suggests, because it carries a lot of flavor. 2. Serving size. In study after study, the bigger the serving size, the more people eat. One example, when we increased the serving size of foods we offer to people by 50%, they ate roughly 425 more calories, about 20% more, per day, says Rolls. And that was sustained for 11 days, leading to a total of 4,635 more calories. When it comes to restaurants, a 50% boost in serving size ain't much. Since its opening in 1955, the largest size McDonald's French fries have gone from 2.4 to 5.9 ounces, the largest burger, meat only, from 1.6 to 8 ounces, and the largest soda from 7 to 30 ounces. That's down from the supersize era, when the largest fries hit 7.1 ounces and sodas reached 42 ounces. A typical sit-down restaurant entree, plus sides, has 1,300 calories. What may help? When we offered people a doggy bag at the start of a meal, larger servings didn't lead them to eat more food, says Rolls. 3. Variety. As you eat a food, your liking for it declines compared to other foods, explains Rolls. It's called sensory-specific satiety. That's why you always have room for dessert. At a buffet, ordering an appetizer, the more items served at one meal, the more you're likely to eat. It's not just foods or flavors. When we offered pasta in three different shapes, people ate more, says Rolls. We're programmed to seek variety. As humans evolved, eating a variety of foods ensured that you'd get a variety of nutrients, notes Rolls. But now, much of our variety is coming from different flavors and textures. So, we may satisfy our need for variety by grazing on 48 flavors of Lay's potato chips, 14 different Doritos, 16 Cheetos, 7 Fritos, and 17 Tostitos, when we should be eating, say, 10 different fruits, vegetables, beans, etc. But you can harness that need for variety, says Rolls. Keep a variety of fruits and vegetables around, so when you get the munchies, you can please your palate without excess calories. 4. Liquid calories. Soda, orange juice, lemonade, milk. It doesn't matter what you drink with a meal. You'll likely consume more calories than if you drink water or another calorie-free beverage. People don't compensate for the calories in a beverage by eating less food, says Rolls. In contrast, we do compensate for the same food when it's in a solid form. When people ate apple slices 15 minutes before lunch, they ate fewer calories at lunch than after a preload of pureed apple or apple juice, even if researchers added fiber to the juice. Starting a meal with fruit or salad can cut back on what you eat next, says Rolls. The chewing and stomach distension and the intact fiber slow stomach emptying and help you feel full. But a salad starter only helps if its calorie density is low, that is, if it's mostly vegetables. Weigh it down with cheese, bacon, croutons, or full-fat dressing, and your meal ends up with more, not fewer, calories. Starting a meal with soup can also trim your calorie tab, even though soup is a liquid. Of course, a calorie-dense, creamy, or cheese-laden soup will likely drive up your total calorie takeaway. And 5, texture. Burgers, fries, pizza, pasta, burritos, sandwiches, mac and cheese, ramen noodles, pancakes, donuts, cupcakes, muffins, ice cream. A lot of our foods and meals are soft, so they're easy to eat quickly, says Rolls. In several studies, foods with a hard texture led people to consume fewer calories than softer foods, whether the foods were ultra-processed or not. It's too early to know if some unique feature of ultra-processed foods may promote weight gain, but it's already clear what makes many foods easy to overeat. Many ultra-processed foods are high in calorie density, says Rolls. They're often soft and easy to eat quickly. They're tasty and well-liked. All those food properties lead to excess intake. Joint Solutions: What to Know About Osteoarthritis by Caitlin Dow. Roughly 33 million Americans are living with osteoarthritis, a degenerative joint disease that can make it a challenge to get through the day. Here's the latest on what causes the pain and stiffness and what may or may not help. How arthritis starts. The whole joint. Researchers used to think that osteoarthritis was only due to wear and tear that, over time, broke down the articular cartilage, the cushioning that pads the ends of our bones. Now we recognize that all structures of the joint are affected, says David Felsen, a professor at the Boston University of Chobanian and Avedisian School of Medicine. That includes the cartilage, the bones, and the synovium, the lining of the joint that secretes fluid to keep it lubricated. You get inflammation in that tissue, called synovitis, and that leads to more inflammation, further damaging the cartilage and bone, explains Felsen. Osteoarthritis can happen in most joints, but the knees and hips are the most likely to cause people trouble, says Felsen. The hands are often affected too. Mechanics and inflammation. Two long-term stresses can spur arthritis. One is mechanical, says Stephen Messier, director of the J.B. Snow Biomechanics Laboratory at Wake Forest University. That is, either excessive loads or normal loads applied in the wrong direction. Translation: excess body weight, injuries, or even malalignment in the joint, like having knocked knees or bow legs, can cause mechanical stress that puts the joint at risk. But inflammation is also to blame. Think of a wound on your skin, says Felsen. You get an inflammatory response that helps trigger healing, but the joint isn't as capable of healing. Why not? Cartilage lacks a blood supply that delivers oxygen, nutrients, and white blood cells to repair the injury. Instead, the inflammation causes more damage and more inflammation, eventually leading to destruction of the joint and a lot of pain, says Felsen. Knee injuries. It's not just the obvious injuries that boost your risk of osteoarthritis. Sure, it could happen to a football player who tears his ACL or someone who tears their meniscus playing tennis, says Felsen. But it could also be an unrecognized minor injury, like if you stepped off the curb wrong and somehow damaged a structure in your knee, even though it didn't bother you. Those small injuries can cause a defect in your cartilage, your meniscus, or some other place in the joint that leads to further damage. A meniscus is cartilage that acts as a pad between your shin and thigh bones. Each knee has two. The meniscus is like a washer, Felsen explains. It provides a spacer between the two bones and the layers of cartilage at the end of the bones. When the meniscus gets damaged, either it tears or deteriorates, you lose that spacer function. That means the joint leans a little toward the area where the meniscus has been damaged, so the knee is a bit malaligned and unstable. Our data suggests that people with a torn meniscus, even those who aren't symptomatic enough to warrant surgery, have a very high risk of developing osteoarthritis. Would arthroscopic surgery for a torn meniscus prevent osteoarthritis? If the meniscus can be repaired, that tends to be better long-term than if the surgeon has to remove part of the meniscus, says Felsen. But the risk of osteoarthritis may still be increased with or without surgery. What to do? First, shed pounds. Other than age and injury, excess weight is a main driver of osteoarthritis, especially in the knee. Due to rising obesity rates, we're now seeing osteoarthritis in much younger folks, says Felsen, like 30 and 35-year-olds who have no history of major injury to their knees, but they just have too much weight and their joints can't easily bear. Losing weight helps even if you're already suffering from arthritis. Wake Forest's Stephen Messier and his team looked at data from a trial where participants with knee arthritis lost weight by eating a low-calorie diet either alone or with exercise. After 18 months, pain scores were 20% lower in those who lost 10 to 20 versus those who lost 5 to 10% of their weight. The more you lose, the more you improve, says Messier. That also means that it's easier to walk, stand, squat down, or kneel. Our studies show that for every pound of weight loss, there is a 4-pound reduction in knee compressing forces for each step during walking, says Messier. Lose 20 pounds and your knees feel roughly 80 pounds less force. Of course, losing weight and keeping it off isn't easy, but that may change with new drugs like semaglutide or Wegovy and tirzepatide or Zepbound, which lead to an average 12 to 18% weight loss. In September, Novo Nordisk, the maker of Wegovy, completed a trial looking at knee pain and function in people with knee osteoarthritis who were given semaglutide for 16 months. Stay tuned for results. Just keep moving. Steering clear of exercise for fear that it's going to further damage your knees or make your pain worse? Stephen Messier is here to convince you otherwise. When people in our studies first start exercising, they say, "This hurts," and I tell them, "You just have to work through the initial bit of pain. We have decades of data to show that in the end, that pain will go down." How much? In one of Messier's studies, pain scores dropped by roughly 30% in people who combined walking and strength training. And when people combined exercise and weight loss, pain scores dropped by 45%. But Messier wanted to know if high-intensity strength training curbs pain even more. The idea is that you improve the strength of the leg muscles, and they act as shock absorbers and reduce the load on the knee, he explains. So he randomly assigned 320 older adults with knee osteoarthritis to a control group that attended monthly meetings about healthy living or to high or low-intensity strength training groups that lifted weights 3 times a week. The high-intensity group lifted a higher percentage, about 75 to 90%, of the maximum weight they could lift, but they did fewer repetitions, says Messier. The lower-intensity group lifted about 30 to 40% of the maximum, but did more repetitions. As both groups got stronger, we bumped up the weight. After 18 months, the intervention groups were significantly stronger compared to the control group. But the high-intensity lifters got no stronger and had no less pain than the low-intensity lifters. So at least for knee pain, there was no benefit or harm in heavier lifting. The surprise? Pain scores dropped by 30% in all three groups. It made us wonder what we did, says Messier. Well, what we did is we paid attention to the control group. We didn't just call them a few times throughout the study. So we're wondering how much of the reduction in pain with exercise is just due to people paying attention to people. It's too early to know if we'll find similar results in other studies. In the meantime, Messier still prescribes exercise, and not just for its impact on knees. "I've been running with the same group every Sunday for the past 30 years," he says. "My wife has her spinning group. These are huge parts of our lives." Messier's bottom line: exercise is a good thing for everybody, but certainly for people with knee osteoarthritis. The good news? No type of exercise, walking, strength training, yoga, tai chi, etc., seems to help more than any other for arthritis. Exercise however you want, but do something, Messier urges. Can exercise and weight loss help prevent osteoarthritis in people at higher risk? Messier is conducting a study in women over age 50 with obesity to find out. Supplement savvy. In 2022, the global market for bone and joint health supplements was estimated to be worth $11.7 billion. but the evidence that most of them do much, if anything, is underwhelming. Take glucosamine and chondroitin. Glucosamine and chondroitin are components of cartilage, so the idea was that you take these orally, and somehow they'd get into the joint and into the cartilage, recalls Felsen. And in early industry-funded trials, taking glucosamine and chondroitin markedly eased pain. But the well-designed, large, publicly funded trials have shown no effect on pain or function, says Felsen. So even though recommendations to take glucosamine and chondroitin have been removed from arthritis guidelines, they are still very popular and very lucrative supplements. Ditto for vitamin D and fish oil, both of which failed to ease knee pain in a large recent trial. What about the supplements with the latest buzz, turmeric and curcumin, one of the active ingredients in turmeric? There have been about a dozen trials, and they've all shown that curcumin works for knee arthritis, says Felsen. But I'd characterize those trials as, I'm not so sure we should trust them studies. Many were company-funded, and some of them showed benefits that were roughly equal to getting a knee replacement. Come on, give me a break. For example, researchers randomly assigned 58 people with knee arthritis to take 500 milligrams of turmeric extract or a placebo twice a day. After 6 weeks, the turmeric takers reported a whopping 70% drop in pain versus just a 25% drop in the placebo takers. But the study wasn't double-blind. The researchers knew he was getting the turmeric. The initial glucosamine studies also showed huge effects that were ultimately disproved by better studies, Felsen points out. Curcumin may turn out to be helpful, but its promise may also vanish once larger, longer, well-done trials are conducted. Help from the pharmacy. Pain pills. We don't have any treatments that slow the progression of structural damage of osteoarthritis, says Felsen. What we have are non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs that control the pain. The stuff you get over the counter, aspirin, ibuprofen, and naproxen, is pretty effective with some prescription and SAIDs work better. The problem? All NSAIDs raise the risk of bleeding and cardiovascular disease, especially in older people. And osteoarthritis is a disease of mostly older people, notes Felsen. Gels and creams. People who can't or don't want to take oral NSAIDs can take topical NSAIDs like Voltaren gel, says Felsen. They're widely used and very safe, but they don't work for all joints. Topical NSAIDs are mostly effective for the superficial joints like the knee and hands, Felsen explains. But the hip joint is too far from the skin surface for the topical painkillers to do much good. And topical NSAIDs may not work for hand arthritis, because people wash their hands a lot, effectively washing the gel down the drain. Topical capsaicin, the compound that supplies the heat in hot peppers, may also offer modest relief for some. But if you get it in your mouth or eyes, it burns like crazy, Felsen warns. That's why guidelines recommend capsaicin for knees but not hands. Just be sure to wash your hands well after you apply it. Injections. Not all injections into the joint work, says Felsen. Guidelines from the American College of Rheumatology recommend against using hyaluronic acid injections. In theory, they increase viscosity, working like WD-40 for the joints. The idea is that if you can increase viscosity, you can protect the joint structures, Felsen explains. The problem? When you inject hyaluronic acid into the joint, it only stays there for about 24 to 36 hours. It doesn't seem to have any long-term benefits. In contrast, corticosteroid injections offer dramatic reductions in pain, but they wear off in 2 or 3 months. Do they also cause the cartilage to deteriorate, as one trial suggested? We looked at data from the two biggest osteoarthritis cohort studies, where participants reported when they had corticosteroid or hyaluronic acid injections, says Felsen. Hyaluronic acid is a good comparator for steroids because we know that it doesn't work very well, but that it's also not harmful. After 8 years, it made no difference whether people got corticosteroid or hyaluronic acid injections, says Felsen. Their rates of joint deterioration and knee replacements were no different. A French study reported similar findings. So it's reasonably established that there's no major harm of occasional corticosteroid injection on joint deterioration. By occasional, he means to treat short-term flare-ups. If someone gets a few injections to treat pain flare-ups, it won't cause them trouble, says Felsen. But are injections, say, every 3 months for years and years safe? We don't know. Finally, going under the knife. Surgery. Considering arthroscopic surgery, which uses tiny instruments to see inside and repair the knee for osteoarthritis, not a good idea. Older people should be discouraged from arthroscopic surgery to clean their knee out or treat a meniscal tear, says Felsen. Meniscal tears discovered later in life are common and often not the cause of knee pain. Researchers looked at 13 trials that randomly assigned nearly 1,700 people with degenerative knee problems like osteoarthritis to get arthroscopic surgery or a conservative treatment like physical therapy, sham surgery, or injections. During the first 3 months, roughly 12% of those who had surgery reported less pain compared to those who got a conservative treatment. But by 1 year, there was no benefit in pain reduction, function, or quality of life for those who went under the knife. Arthroscopic surgery is a waste of time and money, Felsen said. Joint replacement. Surgery to replace a hip or knee can eliminate the pain of osteoarthritis. Hip replacement is among the best surgeries of the 20th century, says Felsen. The recovery is fast, and people are often thrilled with the results within a few weeks. Knee replacements, on the other hand, aren't a slam dunk. While most people report less pain and they're better able to walk, sit, stand, climb stairs, squat, take off their socks, and more, about 20% are not happy that they got a knee replacement, says Felsen. That's because the recovery can take months or even up to a year, and some people end up with lingering pain or limited function. So I hesitate before sending my patients too early for knee replacement, says Felsen, whereas I don't hesitate at all for hip replacement. How do you know when you're ready for surgery? It's when you can't put up with the pain anymore, says Felsen. It's when your knee or your hip is so bad that you just can't do the things you want to do. And now a recipe from the healthy cook, Kate Sherwood. Smoky green bean almondine. A double batch of this side dish would be right at home on a Thanksgiving table, but it's simple enough for any weeknight meal. It's delicious hot or room temperature. To keep the almonds crunchy, add them right before you serve. Ingredients: 1 pound green and or wax beans trimmed, 1 tablespoon extra virgin olive oil, 1 small onion halved and sliced, 1/4 teaspoon kosher salt, 1/4 cup chopped smoked almonds. In a large pan over high heat, bring 1/2 cup water to a boil. Add the beans, cover, and steam until bright green and almost tender, 5 to 7 minutes. Drain in a colander and set aside. Return the empty pan to the burner and reduce the heat to medium. Add the oil to the pan, then immediately add the onion. Sauté, stirring often until the onion starts to brown, 3 to 5 minutes. Return the beans to the pan and shake to spread them out. Sauté, stirring often, until the beans are tender, 2 to 3 minutes. Season with salt, transfer to a serving dish, and sprinkle with the almonds. Taking Aim at Added Sugar by Peter G. Lorre. It's no secret that the U.S. food supply is awash in added sugar. It's not just in the usual suspects like cookies, candy, and soda, but also in sports drinks, energy drinks, smoothies, breakfast cereals, granola bars, muffins, yogurts, sorbets, sauces, and more. Studies report a higher risk of weight gain, type 2 diabetes, heart disease, and tooth decay in people who consume more drinks or foods high in added sugar. And those empty calories leave less room for the vegetables, fruits, beans, nuts, whole grains, and other nutrient-rich foods that can keep us healthy. So in April, Nutrition Action's publisher, the Center for Science in the Public Interest, and the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene petitioned the Food and Drug Administration to set voluntary targets for added sugar. The petition urges the agency to, 1, set targets. The FDA should set short-term, 2.5-year, mid-term, 5-year, and long-term 10-year targets for added sugar for food and drink categories that supply the most added sugar to the U.S. diet. 2, create an online database. A public database of top-selling foods in those categories would make it easier for people to compare added sugar levels. 3, track progress. Public progress reports would pressure companies to meet targets. And 4, tackle restaurant foods. Foods eaten outside the home supply a third of our calories. The FDA needs to set targets for restaurants, foods, and require chains to disclose added sugar in menu items upon request. The agency won't have to start from scratch. Since 2018, the New York City Health Department's National Salt and Sugar Reduction Initiative has worked to set targets for the 15 categories of foods that contribute the most sugar to our diets. It's time for the FDA to step up to the plate by helping all Americans eat more healthfully and not be deluged with sugar at every turn. Wouldn't that be sweet? We've run out of time for today's episode of Nutrition News. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jackie Marino, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Nutrition News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.